You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 6th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dave Roberts of Vox. On those new EPA rulings, what they may mean for our kids and us and the future of the planet. Also on the program today, what was it? There was something that was going on today. Can't remember what it was. Oh, yes, I remember. The greatest day of our lives. And I don't want to get people's hopes up too much. But tonight should be a lot of fun. The Republican candidates are all huddled, desperately trying to figure out how they can escape this evening without looking like more of a fool than most of them. Well, let's be honest. All of them already are. And then, of course, Donald Trump is probably getting, he's probably just having lunch. But a beautiful lunch, probably cooked by the greatest chefs in the world at a luxurious Trump Tower. Well, he's probably out in Cleveland now. I don't know if he has properties out there.
I fly out there at the last possible moment.
I stayed on my plane. My huge, huge 767. Also on the program today, the Democrats announced their debate schedule, rather disappointing. And Jim Webb commits the greatest sin. He actually makes me read, well, I didn't read all of it. I barely read any of it, but something by Joe Lieberman. Scott Walker. Turns out he lied about being John Doe in that investigation back in 2012. I imagine that may come up in the debate today. And Rand Paul, I don't know if he has an election team anymore because they've all been indicted. And perhaps the stupidest thing I've ever read, ever. This time it was on the Netflix parental leave policy. All that and more on today's program. Folks, here's what we're going to be doing. We're going to talk to Dave Roberts. We're going to hear about these EPA regulations, discuss their import. Then we're going to briefly preview tonight. Briefly. We'll take some of your calls. Perhaps we'll go. It'll be a short show. I said short show yesterday. For freebies, it was a short show. It was 10 minutes less, I think, than normal, right? Or no? No,
it actually was just normal.
Oh,
like we just didn't run late.
And then I said, I'm going to do a short show and ended up doing another, I don't know, hour and a half.
That's correct.
I don't know what has gotten into me. I think it's, you know what it is? Too much energy from the vacation.
And it's also that you give and you give.
I give and I give and I give and I can't.
And the audience it's takes like a, and, they, and do they
it's like an
call?
Obsession.
Yes,
it's like
to complain.
I'm compelled. Yes, exactly.
But never to just say thank you.
No, no one ever calls to say thank you. Well, actually, that's not true. People are actually very generous.
I don't remember that.
Well, nobody calls you.
I was trying. Oh, okay. I see. I get it, Sam. Well done.
Thank you.
Well done.
But today we are actually going to do a short show, and then tonight we will be live at two different times. Oh, excuse me. And then immediately after our show today, though, and we will continue the stream. Is that right?
Yes.
Noah will be doing an Ask the Intern segment. This is Noah's last day, folks. Very depressing. But it's a day of mixed emotions. It's Noah's last day, but it's also perhaps Noah's greatest day. And so at 4:40, we're going to go live. You'll be able to watch on the app. You'll be able to see the debate, see us watch the debate. We will comment on it, but sparingly, so as not to to ruin the main course, as it were. We will then stay with the debate, the first one at 5 p.m. Eastern until 6, and then probably 5 or 10 minutes later, we will log off, and then we will be back on live 8:40 p.m., in anticipation of the main event that will go for an hour and a half. Then we will log off or maybe just roll right into an analysis with Cliff Schechter of the debate we've just seen, which will be the podcast tomorrow. So it's going to be a long day for us. We're going to get some food. We're going to get some alcohol and obviously sugary drinks for Matt. And so that's what will be happening. And you can access all of this via the app. Pick it up at majorityapp.com. You can watch it. It's all for free. You can watch it by just hitting the YouTube button at the bottom of the app. You can listen to it as you normally would on the app. We're going to take a break and get to Dave Roberts from Vox. But first, let me just tell you that today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses. They've sponsored us in the past. We got some very good feedback on this. They make obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at, if you've ever bought a mattress, you know, is really sort of an astonishingly fair price. You can now get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority and using the code majority. Apparently, the way that Casper makes their beds, they bring together two comfortable technologies. I have been sleeping on this stuff for years, would never go back. Latex foam and memory foam. So they have just the right amount of sink, just the right amount of bounce, no matter how you sleep. But how can you be sure? They've got a risk-free trial and return policy. They deliver it straight to you. You could try it for 100 days. This is incredible. Some people may just use it if they sublet, I guess, for like 3 months and then just send it back. But I'm not suggesting you do that. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it back up for you. And that is radically different than anything you've ever done in terms of a mattress before, because usually you go into a store, you spend 5 minutes on the mattress, that's it, and you walk out, and yeah, you own that thing. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Compare that to the normal prices of mattresses, and that's an incredible price. So get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority. Use the code majority. Terms and conditions always apply. We'll be right back with Dave Roberts.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dave Roberts. He is a staff writer at Vox. Dave, welcome back to the program.
Hey, good to be here.
So let's talk about these EPA rules. They have been a really long time in the making.
Yes, that's right. The Supreme Court ruled that EPA had authority over greenhouse gases in 2007. And ever since then, it's been bubbling away.
And so let's just talk just briefly, just very briefly about that case. It's fascinating to me insofar as, one, it's rare you get a, not just that the EPA was had the authority, right, but they were compelled to write to treat CO2 as a pollutant, and that case was brought by states who really the only people you could imagine would have standing in a situation like that.
Right, right. Well, the way the process works, what the case, what the ruling said technically is, if the EPA finds that CO2 is a threat to public health, then it is obligated to regulate it. So the EPA still has to go through a whole long process of, you know, justifying the fact that CO2 is a danger to public health, which is not hard to justify, but that was, you know, it's just another step.
And so that ruling happens in 2007 with the Bush administration obviously fighting it. Then the EPA starts to, A, determine that CO2 is a danger to humans, and then what they should do about it.
Right. Well, the first step is when you find it's a threat to public health, the first step is to regulate mobile sources. So that's what the administration's new fuel economy standards were about that they worked with car companies on. And then you turn, first you do mobile sources, then you turn to new stationary sources. So that's the first rule that EPA worked on, which is standards for new power plants, which actually the final version of that rule was also released the other day alongside this other rule, which just came out, which is for existing power plants. And existing power plants were always kind of the big kahuna, the big source that environmentalists, I mean, what happened is that, you know, we have the Clean Air Act was passed in, 1970 or so, and all the power plants that existed prior to that were grandfathered in. They didn't have to meet those standards, and because the assumption was that they'll reach the end of their natural life, and then, you know, new plants will be built that will meet the standards. But what power companies did is just keep those old plants open and running on and on and on and on. So America has had this fleet, this small fleet of extremely old, extremely dirty coal plants for years and years now. And environmentalists have been going after them and after them in every way they know how. So this rule that the Obama administration just issued, which applies to existing power plants, has been the environmentalists' holy grail for decades now.
Wow. So I did not realize that dynamic, and that's fascinating. So what is involved with when you've got a coal-fired power plant that is that, let's say, the normal life cycle, and I have no idea, let's say it's 30 years,
right,
and they don't want to build a new one after 30 years because it's going to cost them more, and they have a grandfathered power plant which can just keep emitting this crap. What do they got to do at that point? Like, I mean, what does it actually get exponentially more polluting because it has gone past its prime, or is it that just they're sending in guys to, I don't know, fix up the drywall, or we're going to get new tile? And I mean, what do they do to keep those things like chugging along?
Well, it's kind of like, I live in a house that was built in 1955, and it has an oil furnace in it, and it's the original oil furnace. And, like, the guy who comes to repair it tells me, he's like, you really need a new furnace. This is a piece of crap. But as long as I come back and keep tweaking it and repairing it, it will basically run forever. And that's sort of the way with the coal plants. Like, if you just keep them tuned up, you can run them forever and ever and ever. And the reason they're so polluting is just that they were built, you know, they're built in like 1950 or whatever, before there were any kind of standards. So, but the trick about...
And they're just not as efficient as, let's say, a new one.
Right, not as efficient. They don't have the scrubbers to take the pollutants out of the gases. They're just they're worse in every way, but they still run. You know, there are coal plants out there that are 50, 60 years old, really old.
Wow.
So, and the trick about regulating these was always the same, which is that if you have a dirty polluting coal plant, there's only so much you can do to clean up the pollution from that plant, especially, and this is especially true for CO2. So the puzzle before EPA was always, well, we can either have them sort of tighten up the efficiency on these individual plants, which will get you maybe like, you know, 6% reductions in pollutants, or we can say you have to shut down that plant and build a different plant, which is beyond the authority of the EPA. So it was always this puzzle, especially on CO2, is we're either going to, it's either a nuke or a pea shooter we've got here. So the brilliant solution that EPA came up with was the regulations that they just released on greenhouse gases don't apply to individual power plants. They apply to states, to the power fleet of a state. So what the states have to do is bring the average reduction, the average pollution from their fleet, from their entire fleet, down. So this gives them flexibility. They can tweak individual coal plants. They can switch from running their coal plants to running their natural gas plants more, or they can build more renewable energy, which will bring down their average as well. So this is how EPA found a way to make the rule, give the rule some teeth, but have it be flexible enough that all the different states could meet it.
And when you say they, you're talking about the states, but the states, this it's not the states that obviously that own these power plants, but they have the regulatory authority to impose a more nuanced solution on the individual owners of those power plants.
Well, power utilities are under state jurisdiction traditionally.
Okay.
And this has always been the model that the Clean Air Act uses. It's called cooperative federalism. So EPA will set the standards and states are given states have the authority to come up with a plan for how they're going to meet it. So states have always had a lot of flexibility under the Clean Air Act, but in this particular rule they have an enormous, unusual amount of flexibility. Not that you hear them thanking the EPA for it right now, but
well, now so, I mean, because obviously that puts some political pressure on them as well, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem is, like, if you're Mitch McConnell or whatever, you're the, you know, the governor of Kentucky or one of these red states that runs on a lot of coal, you don't want to be seen coming up with a plan to implement what the evil, you know, EPA says. But the problem is, I mean, and you probably read in the news, a lot of these red states are just going to say no. That's their big plan. We're just going to refuse to come up with state implementation plans. But the problem is, the structure of the law is, if they don't come up with those plans, then EPA steps in and imposes a federal plan. So it's not like these states are going to get out of having to do this stuff. Instead, they're just going to have a less flexible plan created by the feds imposed on them.
We know they won't respond to that, right? Because that sort of mirrors the whole exchange situation in the Affordable Care Act on some level. Like, you don't want the feds. On one hand, you get out in front of your state capitol and say, I don't want the feds controlling us. We want the ability to run this stuff. And then you say, but at the same time, there's no way I'm going to impose these things, so the feds are going to do it, and I'm going to get.
It's a very similar dynamic.
So you've got these regulations. Let's go through, you know, what they purport to do, or what they hope to do, and you also have written about some of the sort of the potential pitfalls, because I mean the irony. And I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but the irony, of course, of the EPA's solution, they had the pea shooter, they had the cannon, or they could basically defer to the states so that the states could use more of a scalpel, I guess. I don't know what's between a pea shooter and a cannon. But and it's not a scalpel. Maybe it's a knife or a spear or a bow and arrow. And so that the states could use that. But at the same time, that also opens the door to some perhaps legal challenges, I think. But before we get there, let's walk us through exactly what the EPA targets are and, you know, what impact they're going to have.
Right. Well, the regulation is over 1,500 pages long, and it's very complex. And almost all the complexity in it comes from the fact that it's so flexible.
Right.
Like, if the EPA was the sort of out-of-control, top-down regulating monster that you hear it described as, it would have just said, you know, here's one standard, everybody meet it. It'd be one page long. But instead, what it did is it went to every individual state, you know, mapped every single power plant in the state, mapped the age and nature of the power plant, how long the power plants had left on their lifespan. And so for every individual state, it came up with a different target.
Mm.
So technically, you hear that this is going to reduce emissions, power sector emissions, 32% by 2025 or whatever. That's not actually a hard target. That's just sort of the sum of the state targets. So every state has its own individual target, which is based on EPA's assessment of what's realistic and reasonable for that state to do. And those targets are pretty, if you dig into the details, they're not particularly stringent. You know, there are a lot of critics out there right now who are saying, like, a lot of states are on track to hit their targets even in the absence of the rule. So mostly what this rule is doing is just kind of reinforcing or backstopping existing trends that are already underway in a lot of states.
So some of the criticism is essentially like, this ball is already rolling down the hill, and all the EPA is doing is sort of just running behind it and following it down the hill.
Yeah, and that depends on whether you think that ball is going to keep rolling,
right?
No matter what. I mean, a lot of people think that renewables are getting cheap so fast and coal is getting expensive so fast that this is inevitable, but you know, I'm not so sure about that. Like, natural gas prices could go back up. You know, the recession was responsible for a lot of coal plants getting shut down. And, you know, so if the economy turns around and starts growing faster again. So this, I think the best way to view this rule is as a hard backstop that's going to prevent backwards motion rather than something that's pushing really a lot of forward motion. It's more of a backstop that's preventing backsliding.
And in terms of the EPA going state by state and saying, okay, what is a reasonable target for them to hit based upon the existing power needs and their existing power plants, et cetera, that reasonable is obviously sort of a squishy thing, and it's subjective, but that's going to be important in terms of, at the very least, it seems to me, any court challenges, or at least some subset of court challenges, right? Because they're just going to simply argue, did the EPA take into account all the factors that were necessary to come up with a reasonable target?
Well, the legal challenges are not focused on that. There's a bunch. They sued. One group of states went to a district court and demanded a stay on the rule before it was even issued, and the court was like, "Can we just hold on and see the rule before you sue, please?" So, you know, one of the legal challenges has to do with a very technical reading of the statute in question. There were two amendments passed in 1970, and which one you choose to read depends on whether the rule is legal or not. So that's one, and that has to do, you know, this is interesting based on these more recent Supreme Court cases that we've seen. So that one depends on the court deferring to the EPA's reading of the law. And in traditionally, courts deferred to agencies in their interpretations of statutes, called the Chevron doctrine. Unless it's just sort of outrageous, the court will say, okay, that's the agency's prerogative. But lately, like in the Mercury case that just came down, this Supreme Court has been saying, well, we're going to we're not going to defer quite so much. We're going to step in and make sure you're being more reasonable in your interpretations. So, you know, depending on a lot is up in the air with this court.
Let me just stop you here, because, I mean, this is almost like a topic for an entirely different show, is sort of the way that the court has been dancing around the Chevron principle.
Yep.
It came up in this Mercury case, as you said, and that was about whether or not the EPA had considered the proper sort of, I guess, formula or ingredients into determining what was reasonable, whether or not they looked at cost enough. And it even came up in the context of that last Affordable Care Act case, with whether or not the IRS had the ability to interpret the Affordable Care Act to say we're going to give the tax benefits or the reverse mandate, I guess, for those exchanges that are run by the feds.
Well, what the court said was, in matters where the consequences are so enormous for the economy, we're not going to defer as much. We're going to step in and make sure you've done your due diligence. So this is actually a classic case, this Clean Air Act case, because what EPA has done is found a relatively obscure part of the Clean Air Act it's only been used once or twice before, and never for anything even close to this size or scale, and they have sort of wormed their way through that one little statutory hole into this enormous economy affecting program. So this is sort of a classic case, I think, where the court is going to be applying more scrutiny, more suspicious, and less deferential than maybe previous courts would have been.
We could end up seeing the Solicitor General argue that, like, to be honest with you, these EPA regulations aren't really that stringent, and so they're really not going to have that much of an implication, as a way of defending the practice of them.
Yeah, that would be another way. But the other big legal challenge, which is also interesting, is that, like I said, instead of just applying these regulations to individual power plants, which is the traditional way of going about this. So, like, you want to reduce, I don't know, SO2, you say, there's your plant, you have to put a scrubber on it. So it's just the plant itself. But what EPA has done here is step back and say, let's take the average of the whole state's power fleet, and not only that, but you can power switch to natural gas for compliance, and you can build renewable energy for compliance, and both those pieces are quote-unquote beyond the fence line of the individual power plant. So then the legal question is, does EPA have authority under these regulations to issue such a sweet? I mean, does it have authority, for instance, to take into account a state's ability to build renewable energy, which technically has nothing to do with the polluting power plants, right?
Right.
So it's beyond, they're regulating, or this is the accusation in the lawsuit, they're regulating beyond power plants. They're regulating beyond the authority they're given in the Clean Air Act.
Right.
And this
they're
another one where
this is state control of how we do power, as opposed to state just putting regulations on specific power companies.
Right.
Power
it's a regulation on the power fleet overall. So this is another example. I mean, and EPA has read the statute as authorizing that. But it's a contentious reading, and this will be another example where if the court wants to go stomp in and say, no, we don't think that's reasonable, they could sandbag the whole thing. So that, this is a really – like if the court wanted to stick a thumb in the Obama administration's eye on its way out, this would be a really good way to do it.
Oh. I can't imagine they would want to do that. That seems so. All right. So,
what Kennedy had for breakfast, right?
Right. Exactly. Well, all right. So, but before we move on to sort of like the broader implications of this, both sort of in terms of direct impact and sort of ancillary political impact, how is nuclear? Does nuclear in any way, is it implicated by this? Does that become a, I'm using air quotes, a sustainable alternative? Could a state say, like, okay, we're going to make it easier for nuclear power plants or what?
Yeah, that's a very contentious issue, and it's very complicated how it came out in the rules. But I think the short answer is what nuclear advocates were hoping was that the rule would support extending the life of existing nuclear plants, which are a big chunk of the low-carbon generation in a lot of states. But the rule ended up not really supporting existing nuclear plants, although it does give credit for new nuclear plants. So nuclear sort of got a mixed bag in the rule.
Okay, so let's go to this question of just, you know, some people have been touting this as the biggest thing that is going to happen and could have happened in the Obama administration when it comes to fighting climate change. And others have said, and we've alluded to it, like, well, we were all headed in this direction anyways. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Right. Well, I mean, this is the most boring answer a commentator
that's
can give.
That's why we booked you.
But it's too soon to tell, basically. I mean, it's too soon to tell how big of an effect this rule is going to have. It depends on how the legal challenges come out. It depends on how seriously states take it and what kind of, you know, what kind of compliance plans states come up with. I mean, one option that's open to states is to link together into multi-state carbon trading areas. And actually, one of the interesting and lesser commented upon parts of this plan is that, remember I told you, if the states don't do a plan, that the feds come in and, right, and impose one. The federal model plan that they issued might be cap and trade. So you might it would be a really hilarious irony if states like, you know, Kentucky and red states refused to come up with state implementation plans and ended up with cap and trade, which they viciously rejected, as you recall, right, years ago in 2009. So, you know, depending on how states write their compliance plans and, crucially, depending on who the next president is, you know, if we get a President Rubio or I guess President Trump now, there are lots of ways the president can screw this up, slow it down, delay it, weaken it. You know, and Hillary, of course, when she put out her, you know, her clean energy plan the other day, the very first line item on it was, I'm going to defend this plan that Obama just put out. So as for its, you know, as for the effect overall, it just depends on a lot of things that are going to have to play out over the next few years. If you just look at the numbers in the plan, it's not hugely ambitious. It's not revolutionary. It bears no resemblance to the way industry is describing it. You know, of course, industry is already squawking. This is impossible. It's going to shut down their power fleets. You're going to have reliability problems and blackouts, and bills are going to go up. That's all nonsense. None of that stuff is going to happen. It's not a big enough effect on things that people are going to see a marked immediate effect. I mean, compliance doesn't even begin until 2022.
Right, but I mean, it's their job to basically scream bloody murder anytime any regulation is passed, because it's almost like their expected role, because if they don't, in their minds, they're saying, regulate us more. And so they have to scream bloody murder.
This is the dynamic around the Clean Air Act that it's very dysfunctional, and it's been going on for decades, which is basically like EPA forcing inch-by-inch progress and industry fighting it every single step of the way. It would be nice if we could go back several decades and figure out some better way of going about it. But this is sort of like the culmination of decades of those fights. But, you know, I think the fact that industry is complaining so loudly about it should indicate that it's not quite the nothing burger that, you know, like Michael Grunwald at Time has been saying. It's you know, it's just a useless rule. It hardly does anything. It's not already happening. I think the fact that industry is complaining so much should indicate that there's significance to it beyond just the numbers and targets in it. I mean, we're going to go from being a country where, you know, power plants can emit greenhouse gases for free and not care about it at all, to one where greenhouse gases are regulated. So even if the regulations themselves are not super stringent, that is a phase shift. That's a big deal. You're going from a country that's not trying to reduce climate emissions to one that is. And so that's a, you know, so every, and part of it is like there's lots of utilities and lots of states that are moving really quickly on this already, lots of states that are already progressing really fast on this, lots of states where renewables are so cheap and growing so fast that this stuff is going to happen anyway. But what this,
well, let me ask you this. I mean, because you know, one of the things that sort of resonates for me, and I think it's very difficult to sort of to suss out like what the implication of suddenly a country having a principle that we are saying we this is the direction we want to head in, rather than just being willy nilly, is the you know. Chris Hayes had that piece a while back about, you know, I think comparing climate change to the abolition of slavery,
right.
Not on moral levels, I guess I got to say this, but in terms of what the economics were involved, that there was a sector that had a very, very, I guess, deep investment economically in the existence
right.
of this. And I wonder if the idea of this basically just says, hey, this is the direction we're heading in. We're now trending in this direction. Even if there's uncertainty as to whether or not these rules are going to pass, you can see that there's a level of determination here that prior to now we've never seen. So if you wanted to invest money, this investment becomes significantly more risky to the extent that there's any potential risk factors.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. It's a signal. You know, I was going to say it's a signal to those utilities in those states which haven't been making progress. I mean, this forces every single utility, not just the ones who are progressive, but every single one to start thinking, well, I guess this is real now. I guess it's official. I guess we're going to start have to think, you know, we're going to have to start thinking about our fleet and how to start transitioning our fleet away from carbon intensity. So it sends a signal to all these red states and utility executives who have been holdouts. It also sends a signal to the international community, you know, which is hugely important with the Paris climate talks
right.
coming up. It shows them that Obama's not just talk. You know, it shows them that Obama's actually passing rules.
And
one of the beautiful things is to go back to the slavery analogy is the power. It turns out the power sector has been leaving coal behind now for a good while, for several years, for lots of reasons unrelated to carbon emissions. But so it's actually this one sector is less dependent on carbon than it's been in years and years and years. So this is from EPA's perspective, the perfect time to pounce, like when already the carbon was already leaking out of this sector. So the problem is, the power sector is only like 40% of our emissions, and there's still lots of bigger carbon sources to tackle. Like, for instance, oil and transportation is going to be really big and really, in a lot of ways, more difficult. So, in a lot of ways, this is kind of the low hanging fruit of the carbon fight.
Well, like they say, the best time to get a lawyer is when you don't need one. And so maybe it's the best time to sort of lock these regulations in and to make this broad statement that this is, you know, this is where the future is. I mean, I just remember a guy 20 years ago, some 55-year-old executive. I can't remember exactly how I ended up in this guy's office. But we were talking about smoking cigarettes, which I was doing at the time. And he said, I quit, you know, because I just realized one day this is not in my future. And
right.
and that's in some level what we're saying here is like there is at least an acknowledgement that come hell or high water, no pun intended, this is not going to be our future.
And part of what Gina McCarthy, you know, the administrator of EPA has said before, she said to Brad at Vox when he interviewed her, but in a lot of ways, it's less about for those executives, the holdouts, the ones who are holding out and didn't really believe this was real, for those people to make the just sort of internal psychological switch, like, okay, we'll start doing this. Once they make that switch, I think a lot of them are going to find that carbon reductions are opportunities for those carbon reductions are everywhere, and they're much easier than they thought, and they're much cheaper than they thought. So a lot of them, this is sort of the EPA, what the EPA is relying on. A lot of them, once they start moving, will move more quickly than the rule dictates, just because once they get in motion, they'll see it's easy. They've just been sort of closing their eyes and holding out this long, but it's a psychological switch. Like once they start looking around for opportunities, they really are everywhere, and it will be, and then sort of everything will start gaining momentum on its own, and the rule will become sort of vestigial. It'll become unnecessary. That's the hope.
That makes sense. I mean, it also, it seems to me, gives them a couple of arrows in their quiver to say to their board of directors and their shareholders, like, look, we're compelled to do this. It's quite obvious right. This is the future, and so this is the direction we're going. Right.
And you were very, acute in saying one of the big effects of this is that it raises the risk involved in any big investment that involves a lot of carbon. And this is a big thing that's been going on in the green world these days, is this risk. What greens have been trying to say to big businesses, oil and coal alike and natural gas, is carbon is a risk. And right now it's unpriced. Right now you're not being penalized for it, but those penalties, those regulations are coming. They're inevitable. They could come any time.
It would suck to build that power plant now and then find out in 5 years from now that things going to cost you four
exactly.
times
you're
what you thought.
You're going to get stuck with stranded assets. Yeah. It's called unburnable carbon. So they're trying to sort of convince the business community to view carbon itself as a high business risk.
All right, Dave, before I let you go, we've got the big debates tonight. You are, and I've been following your writing for years back on Grist, and when you took your year off, it was a very sad time for me. I managed to pull through, but you, more than most writers on any topic, have spent a lot of time trying to understand the conservative mentality. And so I'm curious as to your perspective on the debates tonight. Are you going to watch them?
Hell yes. Are you kidding me? I'm popping all the popcorn.
So just give me your take on the Trump phenom. I mean, I know that my guess is that you are far less surprised by it than most who commentate on these things, because you have been aware for years that Trump is the sort of almost like the every conservative on some level.
Right. The conservative id. I mean, I was surprised by Trump's sort of meteoric emergence and rise. I'm not surprised by the sentiments. I'm not surprised by his popularity, really, because his sentiments, as sort of repulsive as like mainstream pundits seem to find them, are utterly bog common in the right wing base, as you know. But to me, Donald Trump is, you could not have designed a more perfect disaster for Republicans this year, because all of them were focused on showing a new sobriety, because of all the crazy comments about women and acceptable rape and all that crap those last cycles that hurt them so bad. They've trained everybody, like, keep your cool, don't say crazy stuff. We're gonna try to bring the Latino vote in. We need Hispanics badly. We need women badly. We're viewed as old and out of touch. And then here comes Trump, just like ripped the cover off the Republican id, and is just utterly offensive to all Latinos, utterly offensive to women, just like utterly crazy at every moment. And then boom, is the most popular candidate. You could not send a clearer signal to the world what the Republican Party really is right now. It's just a disaster, and they can't drive him out of the race. Yeah. Because he's so rich, he could just decide to run as a third-party candidate and single-handedly screw the Republicans' chance of winning the presidency. So they can't do anything about it. So they're just sitting back watching in utter horror as this unfolds, totally impotent to do anything about it. And maybe this makes me a bad person, but it's so delightful.
Yes.
It's so delightful to watch. It's like the greatest comedy. I really thought that this Republican primary season couldn't possibly match the kind of clownish antics of the last couple, but it has already exceeded my expectations.
Yes, I have to say it has had a distinct impact on my emotional well-being. And I guess that makes me a bad person, too. Dave Roberts, a real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. So much for the best laid plans. We're just going to do a freebie Thursday. We'll do it for another 15 minutes, and then we will go to our final Ask Noah, which This is Noah's last day. It's not going to be easy, folks. Noah was our first ever intern. Did you know that, Noah? Well, it's true. I have no reason to lie about that. And I think I would say this. I would say this even if we had had other interns, but our best intern by far. You can ask questions of Noah via our Reddit and via the hashtag AskNoah, not to be confused with the guy from MTV or whatever that was. Let's go through. I may have time to take one call, but I'm not sure. Let's go through some quick IMs. Just a reminder about tonight. We have I will just give you the final lineup. I think most people know this already, but there are 17 people involved in this. So it can be a little bit tricky. You got my computer up, right, Matt? Okay. So let's go through the lineup tonight. All right. For the Republican kids table, full of the losers who did not reach the top 10. Rick Santorum. Yes, he's still in the race, folks. This could be your last chance to see Rick Santorum as a presidential candidate. Bobby Jindal will be on the stage, making sure you know he's not a Muslim, folks. In fact, he may even have his own, like, Periscope feed, like a little surveillance feed. Carly Fiorina will be there. To be honest with you, nobody's been paying enough attention to her. But I wonder if she'll have to answer for running, HP into the ground. Lindsey Graham, still in the race. I think he's somewhere polling right around 0.07%. And you only feel good about polling at 0.07% when you're on stage with George Pataki and Jim Gilmore. And then finally, Rick Perry and his glasses will be there tonight at the grown-up table, which is actually really not so grown up. Ladies and gentlemen, in the pole position, in the center of the debate stage, surrounded by those trying to climb up upon Trump Tower. Towering over them will be Donald Trump. Then, of course, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, apparently he was under investigation. Mike Huckabee. Well, the real question is, will Huckabee push any vitamin sales tonight? Cinnamon-based solution to diabetes. Dr. Ben Carson will be in the house. Will he raise a copy of Mein Kampf and tell everyone this is what has happened to America?
Ted, or will Huckabee beat him to it?
Ted Cruz will be there. Mr. Bacon. Marco Rubio will be there. Apparently, in the pre-debate, he has required multiple bottles of water. Rand Paul, who's half of his campaign team got indicted the other day, right? From their
time to call your Jews. All right, everybody.
Chris Christie yet to be indicted. Soon. Oh, did I even forget to mention Rick Perry's still under indictment? Okay, sorry about that. Chris Christie, and then the only person who I think may prove to be the only one who can say anything to Donald Trump will be John Kasich. That's right. I brought that down. There you go. So there you have it. That is the lineup tonight. Here's like the sort of the, between the two debates. Here's my big sort of piece of analysis. Like, if you're in the little kids debate, now had Kasich been there, he would have tried to become the adult in there. I imagine Rick Perry is actually going to try and become the adult. The question is, will Bobby Jindal and Rick Santorum end up dragging them down into the gutter? I don't know. Because, you know, they, in this situation, all they're trying to do is to get somebody at Politico or to get one of those guys like Halpern or one of those guys to say, hey, they did great in the debate. This is a candidate that should really be, people should pay more attention to. In the big boy debate, I think Donald Trump is just going to start out, like I say, by saying, hey, I'm not going to pick on anybody, but if I didn't think, if I thought that any one of you was actually qualified to be president, I would not have jumped into the race, given up $400 million because NBC wanted me to be the star of their TV show because I did great. And Macy's wanted me to keep selling my things because I did great. And the LPGA or the PGA wanted me to you know, sell golf shoes because I was great. But I gave all that up because I care about America. And if you guys were in any way competent, I wouldn't even have to be here and I could go out and keep making money. That's, I imagine, how he's going to start the debate. And then all of them are going to have to address it or they're going to look weak. And we all know that the most important thing in Republican governance is to rhetorically not look weak. All right, let's go to the IMs. Lucifer Morningstar, damn it, I always forget my train of thought when I call in, but this is what has been bugging me about Sam Harris. He supports torture with the idea that we have to choose between torture and bombing, forgetting that it was confession under torture that led to war in Iraq. Second, Sam Harris thinks that secularism is a good idea. Meanwhile, he ignores the largest impediment to it, the U.S. government who actively works against democracy in the Mideast. Third, other stupid crap, he says. There's even more about the torture and bombings, but I'm not going to get into Sam Harris today, but in the future I will. Zero Nafra, I won't narc to the FCC, but are you really broadcasting actual video of the debate? Fox isn't making it accessible. Well, I don't know what the FCC has to do with it, but Morella. Hey, Sam, I visited my daughter last month and found out she needed a new mattress. I referred her to Casper using your link, and she was happy to try it out and get the Majority Report discount. Also very happy with the new mattress now. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. Criso, for those getting the stream other ways than the app, with all the awesome events, be put through the usual. Yes, everything will be the same as the show as you're listening now. Lawn Chair Media, Trump shouldn't run as an independent. He should start his own party inspired by his hair. Golden Dawn. Atlas Plugged, started a new job in Silicon Valley, so upgrading to Dirty F and Hippie in honor of South Bay. All right, well, you're going to get PDX NY, Pedix and Tony. What if both debates are total snoozers? This is what those three Slate political gab fest pundits think will happen. It's a stage full of Republican politicians. After all, if this happens, do you guys promise to get totally bombed to be the main attraction? Indeed. The first one could be a snooze. Yes. I just don't think that Trump, I mean, if those guys on political gab fest think that Donald Trump is going to go in there and be low key, I'm sorry. They don't understand anything. They don't understand anything. So I hope that wasn't their point. I hope their point was, look, this is Fox. They're going to give them questions that are going to make the whole thing very, very tame. Yaram, I strongly recommend the latest This American Life. It's about desegregation in schools. It's infuriating. It's a really heartbreaking episode. I can't believe we're still dealing with this. You know, I heard about that, actually. I got to check it out. Godwin, what does he think about natural gas, the undercounting of methane leakage from its wells? Well, that is a source of CO2, definitely. It's not as great as these coal power plants, coal-fired power plants. And so I don't know if the newer wells are supposedly better, but I think the idea is that even if people switch to natural gas, that's already been baked into the cake. In other words, you're not going to see a growth in drilling beyond what we have. You're not going to see more. You're not going to see new wells. Gaffley, it's time for Jimmy Dore on a Friday again. It's been too long. Indeed. Nick, Sam, it's not just a big day, but as the Donald would say, huge day. Not just one big event, but three. One, 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. Two, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act of 65. Three, oops, I forget. Enjoy, and thanks for giving and giving and giving. What's the next one? Actually, it's the last show of Jon Stewart tonight. I got to remember to record that. What question would you ask Chris Christie about his sex life? It would just be, why? Why?
How are you alive?
Why? Savannah, on Lawrence O'Donnell last night, Tim Pawlenty said it was the Democratic Party that was in disarray, not the Republicans, because they have an avowed socialist running. O'Donnell said, you're a socialist, too, unless you want to say right now that you want to get rid of Medicare and Social Security. I wish Debbie Wasserman Schultz had given that answer. Indeed. What is Lawrence O'Donnell? He loves Tim Pawlenty. He thought Tim Pawlenty was going to be the nominee in 2012 for like a year before. Lone Star Liberal. Hey, Sam, have you read the article in Mother Jones about Clinton talking to Trump before this election and convincing Trump to get into the cycle? I think you're overstating. Clinton gave him advice, probably flattered him a bit. I don't think Clinton convinced him to get in. I think he, you know, and Clinton is like one of those guys who sort of famously will talk to anybody. Great Lib Forward, perhaps not a difficult prediction, but I think Bush will fail big time tonight. He lacks the charisma already and can't really attack the party favored Trump. That leaves him nowhere to go. He's being between a rock and a hard place. I think his handlers will put him in neutral and hope that the rest will fight it out. He'll end up looking wishy-washy and the base will punish him for it, at least in the short term. It's going to be interesting to see. I don't know. I really don't have a sense of what everyone's strategy is tonight because I cannot imagine there's a single Republican strategist who says, I mean, short of Kasich, I honestly believe because, look, I mean, what is Jeb Bush's brand? He's the moderate in the race. Like, how is he going to survive in this race as a moderate? Like, you know, he's going to be the one who's going to project that he can win? I don't think so.
He's starting to remind me of a little bit of a Huntsman quality.
No, to me, he's reminding me of like a Fred Thompson, just like a nothing burger. I mean, look, he's going to get up there and he's going to say, he's going to try and project, I'm a moderate. But look, the only reason why a Republican would ever vote for a moderate, okay, or I'm talking about the average Republican, is because they're convinced that he can win. But Trump's just going to say, you're not good in the polls. You think that the country's going to vote for another Bush? He doesn't have. Mitt Romney became the nominee because there was a sense that he could win. He was just conservative enough for the base. But the reason why you say just conservative enough for the base is because the other half of that is he can win. There's been no indication that Jeb Bush can win, can beat anybody. What's he going to say? Like, if Lincoln Chafee is the nominee, I will win. That's about it. And that's the problem that the Republicans have because there's no one who can make a compelling argument that they can win. That's all that Jeb Bush had going into this race. And Scott Walker's going to try and run on his anti-union bona fides and his small government and his record, and Trump is going to eviscerate him on that. And the other guys are going to, I don't know if anybody, I think they're all probably aimed towards Trump if they can, or they're all trying to dodge him. I mean, this is like an episode of Survivor. You guys going to be on tonight? Ask Noah, what is your favorite part of being on the Majority Report? Are you guys on tonight? Yes, we're on tonight. Fight test. If you want to example how little Republicans care about the poor, the Alabama House cut $156 million from Medicaid, which could effectively end the program. Up to one in five people in the state use. We have to hope that sanity prevails. Unbelievable. Red Fox. In every age, the vilest specimens of human nature are to be found among demagogues. Thomas Macaulay. Hope everyone enjoys the GOP debates. Any good drinking game suggestions? Yes, just drink heavily. Bush and Cheney's, I love it. Dentist who killed Cecil hires armed security guards after vandal sack vacation home. I love Sam Cedar. Ask Noah F. Marry, kill, Sam. Michael and Matt. I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
You don't know what that means, Noah?
I know what it means.
It means F, marry, kill. Three of us. One you got to marry, one you got to F,
kill. Okay. Mark in the A10. Mark in the A10. Hey, guys, two things. Back in black, you guys couldn't find Send in the Clowns? Well, we wanted to save one for tonight. Every time I hear that Jim Gilmore is running, I keep thinking, wow, that guy from Half Baked for President? Not bad. Wait, was that Jim Gilmore? Is that the comedian? Was that his name? No. The guy who did Donkey Boy or whatever it was?
Jim Brewer.
I don't know. Noah, awesome job on managing the deep archives and a pleasure to have you as part of the family. Wishing you all the best and fun, fabulous time on your London School of Economics year. Hope you enjoy London as much as I did. It's from Neff. Wait, when do you go?
Junior year fall semester, says Noah.
Yeah, but when would that, so when, you got some time.
You don't know junior year fall semester, Sam? Jesus, get on the ball.
I didn't know. Huckabee, sounds like an anti-GMO natural healer. No eating organic is not a cure for AIDS. I'm hoping all the neocons attack Rand Paul in foreign policy. I want to see if he holds a line on libertarian principles or he panders to the idiotic Republican voters.
I will be pandering this evening.
What?
Just heads up, Jew.
In case you haven't heard, the other big news today, Democratic debates have been scheduled. Yes, but sooner than that, Bernie will be speaking at Liberty University on September 14th. Your thoughts? I love it. Great. He's not going to be going as someone who's looking. I think it's great. I think it's great. I don't have too much time to go into it. But Kevin 11721, could the Trump experience cause Republicans to question the wisdom of supporting influence money has in politics? The party can no longer control. No, that ship has already sailed. Could the GOP seek a return of party funding of candidates? Maybe, but how can they? Charlie, Sam, debate procedure question. Will there be an actual conk that she will be passed around to indicate who's allowed to speak? Also, Christy, I imagine that Christy will go by Piggy, but will Trump go by Jack? Perhaps Ted will go by Roger. I can't wait for this stuff. Adam's belly button. Tonight's going to be great. I'm really hoping Trump finally just calls everyone a bunch of dweebs. Maybe he'll make a W with his hands while they're talking. B. What are the chances Trump gets it together, like hires the right people and really takes down all the other Republicans? I mean, he's got people. There's plenty of, you know, advisors he has. Jay Tingle, this is incredible. Jennifer Aniston got married. Sorry, Republican field. Wait, would the dentist who killed Cecil need an armed guard? He killed an effing lion. Horsery Zachary. I had a quick thought on one way a Biden run is good for Sanders. It makes it very difficult for President Obama to endorse or otherwise throw his weight behind an establishment candidate such as Hillary Clinton. I don't think he'll do that until the very end anyways. Lawyer Matthew, welcome back to the Indie Mike Wormhole. Need to have him back on the show. Yes, Lawyer Matthew, like Bob Uecker, dragged me in to a Indie Mike email chain.
Every time, I love it. It's always like Sam looks up at me and he's like, do you remember the first Geneva Accords that were established to govern chemical weapons conventions in 2002? And I'm like, oh, whoa. So, yeah, let me double check on that for you, Sam. Are you prepping for a Ring of Fire thing? It's like, no, I'm just in a long, drawn out email debate with that same fucking guy. You ask the most sophisticated research questions for your emails with that dude. Because it's all Middle East.
I don't know. And it's so annoying. Control. Well, he's now, it's both Planned Parenthood and the Iran deal.
Like, do you know about the Arusha Accords, Michael?
Facepalm. I know listeners want to know what we can do to stop TPP, but probably very little. But you know who can? Trump. He's already demonizing China. Actually, you know what? I would be surprised if he didn't bring that up. And I think you're right about that. He could make it a little more toxic. Mega Dave, did you ever get into discussing conservative thing? I heard it teased on Tuesdays, but never heard the details. I didn't. I'm getting to the end. Stu, also tonight, the Canadian election debate. Data review. What are you drinking tonight, Sam? Is IPA day, FYI? I'll probably get some beer and... What? What's going on? Noah's... No, apparently.
Yeah, my parents are bringing alcohol, and my dad and I brewed...
What?
Yeah, they want to bring beer, but we also, at the beginning of the summer, we brewed Obama's official honey ale recipe, and we brought a couple of those up.
You're kidding!
No.
Wow.
No, he's not.
That's crazy.
He's not kidding.
Are you old enough to drink? Carson, according to Mediate, streaming the debate live will require cable authentication. How do you intend to do this? Borat. F, marry, kill, Matt, Sam, Michael. Wow, same. Wow, I think we know who Borat is. Noah, thanks for joining MR this summer. Best of luck. Let the clown show begin. Jay-Z, London is a terrible place full of terrible people. Just saying. Ilmec, no, it's been a pleasure. The perfect intern for the perfect podcast. Good luck in England. Jay Tingle, way to step on my literary reference, Professor Griff. Also, did you pay the licensing and copywriting fees to play AC/DC? I'm calling Angus and Brian. We do have an ASCAP license. I got my money on the crowd cheering the death of black people. Maybe even call some of these cops political prisoners. Cyberstrike. From Raw Story, upstate New York, white supremacist blows off own leg while making bombs at home. Oh. Demo socialist. So this libertarian said to me, doesn't the top 10% create jobs? How do I respond? No. No. It's the 90% who buy stuff that create the demand to create jobs. And the final I am really not of the day, but of this show. Oh, wait a second. No, Noge, 2016 GOP Circle of Jerks, SBG, son of a gun. Noah's getting beer from you. You cannot let him go. Oh, dear Jesus, advantage to having an Oregonian intern, home-brewed beer. And the final I am of this episode, Sammy just tuned in. Who will be streaming the debate live online? You guys, check us out at 20 of 5 Eastern and 20 of 9 Eastern. We'll see you then. And then Ask Noah comes up next. I'm going to shut off the IM and then turn it back on just for Ask Noah questions. We're going to do it for 15 minutes. See you tonight.